Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, NFL Week 13, Monday Night Football Edition. I'm your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only Payne Insider. Payne, how are you this fine Monday morning, my friend?
No complaints, aside from the 2022 NFL season continuing to be a little bit of a mystery.
Wonky is always the first word that comes to mind. I'm adopting it from you after us having worked together for as many years as we have. Some curious results, to say the least, dotting the schedule yesterday. We saw favorites absolutely dominate, much to the chagrin of bookmakers all over the place. And obviously, when you look at last night's game, the final contest of the weekend leading into tonight's game, that's probably a microcosm for the way Week 13 has gone. 21-19, the Cowboys and Colts embattled in a tight, hard-fought football game. 33 straight points from the Cowboys, and suddenly they crack 50, accomplishing a feat we haven't seen in the National Football League in a long, long time. 150 yards passing, 150 yards rushing, and 25 points now in five straight games for a team that obviously gets a slight bump given the injury in San Francisco.
The Cowboys are an interesting group from the perspective of, you're right, 21-19 at one point in that game, and 14 of the 21 came on touchdowns on third and long, one of which was thrown 3 yards past the line of scrimmage on third and nine and appeared to have been a tackle, but not tackled and led to a touchdown. So that was one of the weirder games. And then it just started to snowball. You saw what we talked about in that. The Colts don't have the ability to routinely be a drop back and pass team with their offensive line. Then Braden Smith was out, one of their starting linemen, to add to that. So the other thing that's interesting and something to think about when you're capping some of these Cowboys games, Mike McCarthy feels like he's got no problem running it up. Maybe a little job security issues there, he's thinking. I mean, we're watching some of these games. I mean, get into some heavy personnel, hand the ball off. Now the guy's chucking late. So that's going to make some of their totals really interesting, because their defense is certainly causing some of these totals to open potentially a touch short, and they just have no problem running it up.
Yeah, I don't think, or at least you never know with Jerry Jones, so I want to put this out there, but you wonder if Mike McCarthy is still looking over his shoulder at all the rumors that we had this past offseason about Sean Payton taking over. There may be plenty of other jobs for Sean Payton to take, given what we see around the National Football League from a coaching standpoint each and every weekend throughout the season. But as we always do on Monday mornings, we kick things off with the good, the bad, and the ugly. We'll get into some look-ahead lines. Of course, the good Doc Deepak stops by to share injury updates for a lot of the marquee players, and a massive one in Baltimore. We'll see how long it has their franchise quarterback potentially shelved. And last but certainly not least, a deep dive on Monday Night Football between the Bucs and Saints. So, Payne, as far as the good, the bad, and the ugly are concerned, I'll give you the floor to start things off. What did you see that stood out in a positive fashion so far this week?
I'm going to throw it back to you. I'm going to play catcher here today, because my data dump overnight errored out. So I don't have a ton of data that I usually do on a Monday. So I'm going to play catcher today. I'm going to let you lead the way.
Oh, that works. And we can look, and you guys can laugh at the layman's eyes through which I watch the NFL instead of having you tell me that I'm always wrong, which is normally more often the case. Let's kick things off, or start with the Philadelphia Eagles. Obviously, we made a case for the Tennessee Titans as our best bet. That game was dead and buried midway through the second quarter. The Philadelphia Eagles, better against the run, completely bottled up Derrick Henry in that contest. They sacked Ryan Tannehill 6 times, forced punts on 5 straight possessions when the game was hanging in the balance at 14-10. But what stood out to me, Payne, was more Philadelphia on the offensive side. We weren't sure if this team could go out there and win games throwing the football. A.J. Brown, became a force, as we figured he would be a focal point against his old team. But Jalen Hurts, 29 of 39 for 380 yards, despite the Eagles' inability to run the football, 24 totes for 67 yards, showing a little bit more versatility on that offensive side.
Yeah, we weren't sure if Jonathan Gannon would come with the correct game plan, and he did. He kind of bit one from the Bengals playbook and loaded the box on early downs and then dropped back in coverage, knowing that his front four could get to Ryan Tannehill on late downs. Derrick Henry saw 8-man plus boxes on 46% of his attempts, is the fourth highest mark of any running back last week. And then you combat that style of play that the Titans have. And we kind of talked about the emergence of Treylon Burks and what he can do for that offense as a field stretcher. Suddenly you can't cheat into the box as much if Treylon Burks is out there. And sure enough, when he was on the field, he was a weapon, scored the touchdown, obviously, and then departed with a couple minutes to go in the first quarter. And from that point on, it was a mess offensively. There weren't any receiving threats that scared the Eagles. And basically, Ryan Tannehill was throwing in known situations behind a pass blocking O-line that's pretty lackluster, and there aren't a ton of weapons there to make a defense fearful. So I think defensively, Jonathan Gannon made some adjustments, had the right game plan there. Offensively, the Eagles had the right game plan. Sirianni knew he wasn't going to be able to run the ball against the Titans, so he came out with this pass-heavy approach and attacked the Titans' weakest part of the defense, which is their secondary, and Jalen Hurts was fantastic through the air. So from a game plan to execution standpoint, the Eagles were really impressive, and candidly, I thought that was their most impressive performance of the season when you think about playing a little bit left-handed offensively and having picture-perfect game plans on both sides of the ball, who the opponent was, and knowing how good they are schematically, knowing that the Titans opened a 6.5-point dog, closed 4.5, so there was respected money on the Titans, not just us, but other respected bettors and groups out there getting a touch of the Titans. And I think when you put that all together, this was the Eagles' most complete performance of the season.
Yeah, I can't really argue that. I mean, the Eagles have been a team over the last couple weeks that had looked pedestrian. We know it's impossible to sustain a high level of play every single week throughout the season. But the only game for me where I think the Eagles look this dominant against what I would call a good opponent, probably way back early in the campaign when they completely clamped down on the Minnesota Vikings. So kudos to the Eagles now sitting with that gaudy 11-1 record atop the NFC. I'm not sure anybody is going to catch them over the next couple of weeks. A team that has obviously raised its profile in the last few weeks and suddenly sees themselves very much in the thick of things for hitting the back half of that wild card picture pane would be the Detroit Lions. You told me earlier last week they had taken very sharp, respected money against the Jacksonville Jaguars. They went out there, exceeded odds makers' expectations. Offense clicked on all cylinders, didn't have to punt. 437 total yards of offense with Jared Goff putting forth his best game in weeks. They average a shade less than 6 yards per play. Nothing incredibly explosive, but they were consistent. And you look at what they were able to do to sustain drives, but more importantly for Detroit, they were great defensively by Detroit Lions standards, completely shutting down what Jacksonville wanted to do offensively, leading Trevor Lawrence to say that game was downright embarrassing for the Jags.
Jacksonville's interesting from the perspective of down-to-down metrically. They're certainly better than their record indicated. And we thought coming out of the bye, there might be this elevated level of play. And the guys that were betting Jacksonville last week, at least early on, were insinuating that, hey, Jacksonville looked really good against Baltimore. And I went back and watched the game and looked at the data again. I'm like, I know they upset them, but they didn't really play all that well. I mean, some late drives and some early stops in the red zone against Baltimore and some drops from Ravens receivers. It really wasn't this impressive performance from Jacksonville against Baltimore that it was perceived to be. And the Lions were getting some love from the public. And then all of a sudden, quietly behind the scenes, I texted you, hey, I'm starting to like hear and see some Lions movement. Now, if you just look at Detroit, they're playing really good football right now. It's no longer the lovable losers. You know, 6 straight weeks of just competent play, and you can see it in some of the trending metrics for the Lions. They just continue getting better down to down. They're getting healthier. The offense is certainly surging. They're 7th best in EPA per play since week 8 right now. O-line is getting healthier. Swift's workload if you've watched that, is enhancing a little bit, suggesting that he's healthier. And then you had the return of Jameson Williams back this week. And to your point defensively, the Lions are at least competing, right? They've gone from the worst defense in the league to like bottom third of the league unit right now. So incremental improvement defensively as well. And no surprise when you pair the two teams this week in Minnesota and Detroit, why that's trending in one direction far, far differently than what the look headline suggested last week.
Yeah, I think that'll be an important point. We'll get there, of course, a little bit later in the show as you've seen the market respond to not only the Lions' uptick, but also the Minnesota Vikings, who put forth, I guess, what can best be described as a little bit of a fraudulent win against the New York Jets. When you look at the Lions' success, I mean, Payne, does it fall on Dan Campbell? I mean, as in terms of getting this team to play as well as they have? I mean, because coming into the year, we knew that this team had attracted a lot of money as far as their win total was concerned. Weren't sure they were going to have the pieces to be able to achieve that. But it would have been easy to throw in the towel when they struggled, weren't getting the results, and now suddenly they're sitting two games under 500. You win this week, all of a sudden we're talking about the Lions finding a legitimate path to get into the postseason.
I mean, Dan Campbell's a passionate dude, and it was good to see that the overbearing nature, constantly in your face approach, didn't wear down on some of the players when the success on the field wasn't unfolding. I think what you do have here, and you can go back to the preview podcast, we made a case for Ben Johnson before anybody knew exactly who he was, based upon his passing offense when he took over designing some things late last year, and it's really transcended into this season. I mean, I think Ben Johnson has a chance, and it's very early, right? I mean, he's been an offensive coordinator officially for two-thirds of a season, but what he's done with Jared Goff and turning him into a competent passer, and the weapons are starting to get there, and we thought one of the best units in the league quietly was this Lions offensive line. You're starting to see what a competent coach with really a very good cast of characters on an offense can be. Defensively, there's been some improvements. Obviously, some guys were fired and let go, and you started to get a little bit healthier there, and Jeffrey Okuda started playing like the guy that was selected early on in the first round, and you're getting Aiden Hutchinson turning into a pretty dominant player defensively. And so suddenly that's what you're seeing. It's both sides of the ball showing real improvement here, and it's wide open in the NFC. And this week here is a very big game for the Lions. Suddenly you can get back in the playoff picture, just two games back right now as it stands.
So wild. I mean, you look at the level of parity in the AFC, so top heavy as teams at 6-6 just fighting to keep their playoff hopes on life support. But the NFC, being a much more muddled mess, creates drama and intrigue in a very different fashion than what we're seeing in the other conference. Another thing, Payne, that impressed me, and this was more an individual performance. Look, I mean, you're putting up numbers against the Bears. We talked about it at great lengths for what Mike White and the Jets were able to do. It comes, of course, with a caveat, but Christian Watson, widely talked about as the potential game breaker that Green Bay was trying to draft out of North Dakota State, dealt with a myriad of injuries early in the year, from concussions to the hamstring. But my Lord, you try and watch any Green Bay game, it's impossible to avoid the kind of impact that Christian Watson makes, not only as a receiver, but obviously picking up a big play in the ground game yesterday as well, with that game-breaking speed.
Yeah, the Bears caught a wave of sharp money within the hour leading up to kickoff from a very, very respected veteran. So the line closed 3.2, and for three quarters, it looked like a fantastic bet, and it probably was a good bet. And then the 2022 NFL season continued to happen, right? You get a blocked field goal, an end around, and Fields throws two interceptions in the green zone, one of which was on first down, and the Packers not only win, but cover. And you look at the Bears moving forward. Boy, that schedule, the final four games, is an absolute gauntlet. So there was this really interesting middle part of the season where there's intrigue for the Bears, and Justin Fields does look like he's performing a little bit better. I think he's obviously your starting quarterback heading into next season, and you just continue to build around him. But that's going to be a wildly disappointing season for the Chicago Bears. That was a game that they had to win, even in the first half, right before the end of the break. You had a chance there to really solidify your spot there and get off the field. It looked like it was a third and one where the Packers hand it off to Aaron Jones, loses 3 yards, it's fourth and four. Great, you hold to a field goal. No, Green Bay comes out and goes for it on fourth and four, and they just gut you with a touchdown before the break, but you seem to battle back in the third quarter. You won that stanza, so the momentum score before break didn't really hinder you, and then you just fall flat and get outscored 18-0 in the fourth quarter, and that just continues to be a Bears team that just struggles to get over the hump and win games. In terms of what it means for Green Bay, I'm not really sure.
Oh,
I don't really see. Yeah,
I don't think
nothing's going on here.
No.
Yeah, but you see Christian Watson, right? I mean, that guy looks like a dude. It looks like you hit the lotto with him, and Romeo Doubs was humming before his high ankle injury. I would assume that he's back fresh off the bye, and so that'll be an interesting situation moving forward there. It actually looks like Green Bay did quite well with their draft this season.
Well, that's the one thing about it. I mean, why are they criticized for not using first-round picks to try and give Aaron Rodgers the weapons while they have a little bit of youth there? Suddenly, if Romeo Doubs and Christian Watson become guys that you can lean on, we know how dynamic Aaron Jones can be when he's not dealing with nagging injuries, A.J. Dillon, there are some playmakers on the offensive side of the ball, not what Packers fans want to hear, as they're not going to be playing meaningful football into the month of January, but at least a little reason to be optimistic about some of the difference makers they have on their roster. Biggest game on Sunday in terms of its overall impact in the AFC, Kansas City and Cincinnati. For the third time in calendar year 2022, the Bengals get the best of the Kansas City Chiefs. Joe Burrow, cool, calm, collected, 25 of 31, 286 yards. Personally wish they didn't run the wide receiver sweep on fourth and one inside the four-yard line at the end of the first half, but that's neither here nor there. Showed off his running legs, too. And when you talk about quarterbacks, you brought to my attention last year that when the stakes continue to get ratcheted up, that's an element for Patrick Mahomes that defenses have trouble accounting for. And we're starting to see a little bit of that with Joe Burrow. Two of his three biggest rushing games this year have come over the last 2 weeks. Finished 11 of 46 with a touchdown scramble. Went headfirst into the end zone rather than sliding. And it appears that Kansas City has found its kryptonite in the AFC.
Yeah, I think you're spot on. And in terms of Burrow, I thought he navigated the pocket extremely well yesterday. We know early on in the season he was kind of seeing some ghosts and taking sacks. And it was an interesting first couple of weeks for him. Burrow, though, you could just tell he's pretty comfortable all game. And you look what the Bengals did from a protection standpoint. They doubled Chris Jones. And then anytime Spags sent blitz, it was picked up. It's as if they knew exactly the blitzes that were being dialed up. Thought the Chiefs tackled extremely poor. Every play seemed to gain more yards past first contact than you would have liked. Burrow's completion percentage, nearly 14% better than expectation. It was the second best mark of the week. Played well in virtually every high leverage snap except audibling into that play that lost 4 yards when they needed an inch second before halftime. That'll be another one. In the calamity section of 2022 NFL for our loyal listeners out there, had over 24.5 in the first half there, moved that market to about 26.5. Somehow that information ended up trickling out to others. I heard a lot of prominent people in the media talking about that one on social media. So not sure how that information leaked, but it got out there somehow. I just unbelievable way to lose that game. But you kind of look, right? Ended the game with the huge 3rd-and-11 conversion. You mentioned Burrow's legs were a nice added weapon. No matter what transpired in this matchup over the last, you know, three meetings, it just feels like Cincinnati's the more calm team that doesn't have the pressure, that just seems to find a way to win. And we can discuss all the things that are true, right? Burrow was excellent, and the Chiefs didn't get pressure, and they tackled for shit, and the rush 3-drop 8 gave the Chiefs relative problems again. But sometimes it's really as simple as just making a play, right? And despite not having Joe Tooney, your all-world left guard, or Mecole Hardman, or Tony, the Chiefs are leading by 7 heading into the fourth quarter. Right, you're up 4 on a crucial drive, and your best weapon fumbles at midfield. Sometimes it's as simple as that, right? You can't have your best player fumble with a lead, right? You can't have your head coach, specifically one like Andy Reid, crumble late and get out coached by Zach Taylor of all people, right? Like on 3rd-and-3 from the Cincinnati 33 with 4 minutes to go, down 3, like field goal should not be a thought in your mind. It's 4-down territory. You can't attempt the 55-yard field goal just to tie it to then give it back to Cincinnati, who would only need a field goal in the final 3 minutes to win. Right? On 3rd-and-3, you see that light box, right? And you kind of have a vibe for what's transpired in this game so far, right? And it's McKinnon Pacheco absolutely dominating on the ground, averaging nearly 5.5 yards per carry. So there's not a problem in that situation when you see a three-man box. Hand it off. It's four down territory. And even on 4th and 7, like, sure, Mahomes is limping around. You hate to do it, but call a timeout. Let him gather himself. And then you go for it there. That was the far more superior choice when you look at win probability data in terms of kicking a 55-yard field goal in 40-degree temps on the road from a kicker who hasn't been the most, I would say, consistent this season. Harrison Butker obviously battled an injury and was out 6 weeks, but hasn't really regained that form that we'd seen from him in past seasons. So what's the benefit there? Okay, you tie the game. What has your defense shown that you're going to be able to hold Cincinnati out of field goal territory? So that was just very poor coaching, both in the third down call when you got to look at what was going on with the Bengals defensive formation to electing to attempt a 55, 56 yard field goal just to tie a game with 3 minutes to go.
Yeah, you're hoping for the best there, and hope is not a strategy that wins football games against high level NFL franchises in 2022 by any stretch. So Cincinnati gets the big win and a fortuitous bounce on some level for them, despite a grueling schedule coming up. Baltimore down, a key cog as far as their offense is concerned. With the good, obviously, comes the bad. And for me, Payne, I can start with the Cleveland Browns. Deshaun Watson comes back and obviously going to upgrade this offense in due time. But the team gained just over 300 yards versus the Houston Texans, didn't score a single offensive touchdown, still finds a way to cover as more than a touchdown favorite. Watson just 12 of 22 in his return, basically had nearly 2 years off. And I'm not sure if it's Kevin Stefanski being stubborn or what it was. I figured they were going to come out and run the football with Nick Chubb 25 to 30 times, allow Deshaun Watson to work, you know, man coverage on the outside once they could get play action going. But Stefanski had other ideas. It was to come with an aerial assault early on with Deshaun Watson. Unfortunately, they were playing the Houston Texans because it looked to operate in fits and spurts.
One of the more interesting games, because you could have made a case and said, hey, like, this could be the Texans Super Bowl going against, you know, a former player in Deshaun Watson. That'll provide some, you know, motivation throughout the week in terms of preparation and getting up for a game like that. The other side of it would be like, you know, Deshaun Watson's also had like 6 weeks at least to prepare for one specific defense. So whether it was the rust angle you were looking for, Deshaun having ample amount of time to prepare for one team, we saw money come in on Cleveland, took that from 7 to 8. You mentioned some of the things that went on in the ground game. Yes, Stefanski wanted to get Deshaun Watson in rhythm early. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I understand the thought process and the idea. It's like, let's see if we can just get him in form, get him some confidence, make some easy throws. But to your point, like, Nick Chubb was held below expectation on the ground against a Texans run defense that was 30th in schedule-adjusted rush efficiency. So that was really the starting point for the abomination offensively. Houston forced Deshaun Watson to kind of be a factor in some situations where he didn't necessarily need to be, and you could see some rust, right? I mean, the guy hadn't played since January 3rd of 2021, so 23 minutes without seeing, you know, live bullets. I understand there was some snaps in the preseason, but just it's not the same, and Watson ended up not being on the same page with some of his receivers. He finished the week with a completion percentage 17% below expectation, worst mark of any quarterback in week 13. Got to be honest with you, like, he didn't look like he was in game shape, didn't seem to have a ton of energy. The legs looked a little bit wobbly at times. Todd, I would say Deshaun Watson looked drained at times out there, probably the right describing word.
It's going to be interesting to watch his development and evolution in this system over the next couple weeks to figure out. I know where you're going with that. I'm not taking the bait. To figure out what Cleveland has there with Deshaun Watson and how the legs come back a little bit, especially with a massive game this week against an in-state rival that they dominated a few short weeks ago in the Cincinnati Bengals. As far as other disappointments, the New York Jets, Payne. I mean, the defense gave them more than a puncher's chance to get a big win on the road against the Minnesota Vikings. Settled for countless field goals after sustaining long drives. I know that is the number one criteria, or it's embedded in the DNA of Ed Donatell's defense, but at the same time, when you finish with a net plus 1.6 yards per play, accumulate nearly 500 yards of total offense, but go 3 of 16 on third downs, inability to execute inside the 5-yard line, kicking 3 field goals in the second half, 36 yards or shorter, and then get intercepted in the end zone. The Jets deserved a much better fate, coming up short 27-22 in the Twin Cities against the Vikings.
Really difficult game to gauge because it was the tale of two halves. You know, Minnesota came out with a great offensive game plan against a top 5 Jets defense. Justin Jefferson did zip and pip in the first half, and somehow Minnesota had 20 points at the break. Two really long drives of 86 and 74 yards. The Mike White experiment in the first half looked like a failed one. You know, I mean, the Jets had 6 drives in that first half. They went 8, 45, 29, 17, 18, and 33 yards and 2 turnovers. But in the second half, the Jets dominated, and you know, the comeback fell kind of short there. But if you're gauging the game as a whole, as I think we are, the Jets outgained the Vikings by nearly 200 yards. You hit it perfectly, more than 1.5 yards per play better. And when you count getting stopped on downs a couple times, right? The Jets had 4 turnovers. They settled for field goals far too often because of some of their third down struggles. So it was a really difficult game to gauge, and a lot of sharp guys were on the Jets. Couldn't get myself there. It was probably, again, the right side when you look at the game as a whole. But even in that first half, right? Like I'm watching this game and I'm like, this is going nothing like I expected. And at halftime at 20-6, because just for a listener standpoint to paint this picture, the total was an absolute battle. Open 44, got steamed out to 46. Another group came in, steamed the thing under to 44, even closed some spots at 43.5. So there was like an absolute grudge match. And again, I watched that first half at 20-6, and I'm thinking to myself, somehow this game's going to go over, despite the team that was supposed to improve offensively and really push the score, and the Jets are doing absolutely nothing. And somehow the Vikings, again, have 20 points on the board with Justin Jefferson absolutely getting locked down in that first half. So it was really one of the more puzzling first halves. But ultimately, as you alluded to, when the dust settled, the Jets outgained the Vikings by nearly 200 yards. They deserved better. A lot of the professional bettors that believe the Vikings are a fraudulent 10-2, and they're correct in that assessment relative to the record, pulled another one out.
Yeah, Minnesota continues to dance between the raindrops and inches, ever so close to sealing their division title a lot sooner this season than Vikings fans ever anticipated. The game out west between the Miami Dolphins and the San Francisco 49ers, we knew the Dolphins could be up against it with a really banged up offensive line. They come out, first play from scrimmage, hit a home run, 75-yard touchdown pass. It looks like all is going to be well and good. But Coach McDaniel, in the wake of their 33-17 loss, says, guys were a little off just in general collectively, but I know one thing. It wasn't because of preparation, lack of detail. It was one of those things you have to go through. And sometimes when you're an up-and-coming team, you have to get hit in the mouth a little bit to realize where you need to get better to win games of this magnitude. Tua, 3 picks coming into the year, tossed 2 in the fourth quarter. The 49ers' defensive line was able to control the line of scrimmage for long stretches. But obviously, the Dolphins a little bit limited when Jalen Waddle leaves the game in the first with a leg injury, does come back in the second half, but finishes with a paltry 1 catch. Tyreek Hill, the key cog, 9 for 146. But I don't want to cast aspersions or be too critical, but the Dolphins obviously a little ways to go when they step up in class against an elite-level defense.
Yeah, I think you're spot on, and this is something that we talked about. To this point in the season, Tua was playing like your MVP. Mike McDaniel's playing like your coach of the year, but there was going to be a lot of games left with the schedule increasing to find out what Miami truly was. Now, you hit the home run play right off the bat. Great scripted. Looked like Tua was in form. Mike McDaniel knew exactly how to attack his old defense, but Tua was off, right? Even on throws where there were no pressure, he was off. And this is the first time you've seen a guy like that this season not be able to be accurate. And that's his best acumen. And he was 15% below expectation in terms of his completion rate, threw some costly picks in the fourth quarter, as you mentioned. The interesting part to that game was Mike McDaniel, I thought, had the right game plan. I mean, he's still as savvy as ever, because you're down your left tackle, you're down your right tackle, and he got the ball out of Tua's hands quickly. And if you looked at the areas of the defense he attacked San Francisco in all their vulnerable areas, right? Because if you just kind of look at season-long data, this Miami offense had thrived throwing the ball over the middle of the field. And with Fred Warner and those linebackers in Greenlaw, you see how they move from sideline to sideline. That is one of the best defenses in the middle. And so Mike McDaniel knew that off the bat, said, hey, we're going to attack the edges. And right game plan, just didn't execute it all that well. Defensively, we knew Miami was a little bit vulnerable through the air. And I thought even though you look at the scoreboard and see 33, the defense did an okay job. Just a lot of situations where they were put behind the eight ball there. And yes, it's a team that's imperfect. The schedule is daunting. This is a big week for the Miami Dolphins. They're staying out west, going to do some team bonding. You get a Chargers team that's looks to be down and out, although they're a pretty scrappy group. And this becomes a massive game for the Miami Dolphins. Seeing some early money come in on Miami with Tua being upgraded health-wise.
Yeah, it was interesting. He gets a questionable designation, at least on odd screen, gets upgraded on Monday morning without any additional reports coming from the teams. And to your point, why you see soft three out there.
Mike McDaniel said if he needed Tua to go in on that last series, he could have been. It was just at that point the game was done in his eyes.
Yeah, no reason to put him out there. There, Skylar Thompson comes in for one play, promptly throws an interception, and it's game
over the middle.
Over, yeah. Where it looked like there were six red shirts and one potential Dolphins receiver for Skylar Thompson to throw to there. Where with good, the bad, there's also ugly, and we saw an interesting altercation on the sidelines Thursday night. The Patriots get beaten like a drum by the Buffalo Bills, but it's Mac Jones and Matt Patricia making headlines. The Bills said coming into the game their goal was to make New England one-dimensional and that the Patriots were going to have to throw the ball to win. Pat's ground game was mired in mediocrity, and Mac Jones let his feelings be known to Matt Patricia that he was less than impressed with some of the play calls there.
Yeah, I mean, listen, what a weird game in the market. So, very early on in the week, Patriots took big money, took that game down from as high as 6 to as low as 3. And there was some reports, obviously, we knew some guys that were down on Buffalo. They were down their left tackle, Deion Dawkins. A flu bug was going through Buffalo's locker room. And then all of a sudden, as we got off the podcast on Thursday, I'm starting to see this offensive line issues start to roll in for the New England Patriots, right? Trent Brown wakes up with the flu, and all of a sudden, I look into one of our accounts. I'm like, oh my God, they pummeled Buffalo -3, and it was just a very interesting game, a battle there. And again, we talk about pricing mattering, and so at 6, guys like the Patriots; at 3, guys like Buffalo, and it certainly unfolded in the second position when limits were a little bit higher. That position ended up coming home. In terms of Mac Jones and Matt Patricia, this kind of is what it is, and it'll be interesting to see which side of the coin Bill Belichick falls on, because I don't think this is a relationship that can continue past this season, turning Matt Patricia, a lackluster defensive mind, into an offensive coordinator is not the recipe for success. Certainly, Mac Jones isn't any of these elite quarterbacks. But I do think if you can put him in the right, like if he's with San Francisco right now, there isn't a drop off. And I think they can make a Super Bowl run, right? If you were in that type of offense with that type of offensive mind, he's just not getting that type of offensive sophistication out of Matt Patricia. And so ultimately you see those frustrations. There was a joke that at Alabama, Mac Jones, they would call him McEnroe Light because of some of the flare ups and tempers that he would have. But it's to be expected. There were areas to attack the Bills defensively, and it just didn't feel like Matt Patricia attacked those areas. We saw a lot of those crossers and digs over the middle of the field, which simply do not work. We needed to see the ball push down the sidelines. When they did that, there was some efficiency there, right? We needed to see some running back passes. You got them in like known situations, so they weren't all that efficient. Matt Patricia's not a very good coach. He's a below-average defensive mind. He's probably one of the worst offensive minds in this league, and Bill Belichick needs to get that figured out.
Yeah, they'll get it sorted out quickly, at least you would think. New England obviously has their work cut out for them if they're going to be able to make a late push to get into the playoffs. We'll see them on Monday Night Football a week from today on the road against Cliff Kingsbury and the Arizona Cardinals. Pittsburgh Steelers, Payne, back-to-back wins. They look great in the first half against the Indianapolis Colts, bogged down in the second half, had to hold on for dear life. And rinse and repeat, a very similar blueprint this past weekend. They took sharp money on the road, despite it being travel on a short week against the Atlanta Falcons. Build a 16-6 lead going into the half, and once again, can't make any adjustments at the break. Offense looks stuck in quicksand, but they are able to hold on for a 19-16 win. Kenny Pickett has shown flashes and taking the next step in the rookie learning curve that you'd like to see, but I don't know what the hell is going on at halftime for the Pittsburgh Steelers. Maybe it's the Gatorades, it's the orange slices, or it's the Little Debbie snacks that are impacting their ability to make some adjustments. But this is a team that's allowing inferior opponents, you know, after good first halves to hang around. We'll see if that's a trend that continues. A little bit discouraging for Steelers fans who haven't been able to get that rocking chair winner.
Listen, I mean, this isn't a great team by any stretch, but I think you have to be very optimistic with the Steelers moving forward, and that they've just played a really difficult schedule to start the season. They've come out of their bye having a clue, and this is the reason they've been steamed back-to-back weeks, because the underlying metrics have been very good since the bye. You mentioned Kenny Pickett not turning it over. Missed some throws even early on in that first half, and that game could have been certainly more lopsided early on. But what you're seeing at halftime, to your point, is Matt Canada is not a great offensive coordinator, not a guy that's going to make a ton of adjustments, very regimented, very predictable. And Mike Tomlin's a defensive-minded coach. So what comes with that? Oh, we're going to protect these leads. So it's really twofold, with Matt Canada not being the best offensive mind you've ever seen and not really doing a ton of in-game adjusting. And it wasn't just this week. It wasn't just last week. We saw it even in the Bengals game. And then you have a defensive-minded coach who said, hey, it's now my job to protect this double-digit point lead, and they just get a little conservative and shell up, which is not very shocking. But overall, you're winning games. You're winning them as an underdog. You're winning them on the road in coin flip type situations. I'm seeing improvement here from Pittsburgh, so I'm not ready to completely crap on them.
No, they've definitely been better. I mean, we looked at their strength of schedule coming into the year. We knew it was going to be an uphill battle. This gave them a little bit of a respite, and they've been able to reap the benefits with back-to-back road wins. We'll see if that momentum carries forward when they get to play host to the Baltimore Ravens this coming Sunday. The final thing, as far as the ugly, had nothing to do with an individual's performance or a team playing poorly, anything along those lines. The San Francisco 49ers will have to make a run to the NFC Championship with a third-string quarterback. Jimmy Garoppolo, broken bone in his foot. Looks like he is going to officially be lost for the year. And you have to wonder if Brock Purdy is ready to assume the reins and do enough as caretaker for San Francisco offensively, given how talented and deep they are on the defensive side of the ball when you look at the pecking order in the NFC.
You know, unfortunately, this probably means that there is not a Super Bowl run in the 49ers. The move they made this morning before we started recording was signing Josh Johnson.
Has Josh Johnson now played for every team in the league, or how many teams do we have left for Josh Johnson to go sign with in some capacity?
I'm not sure, but good for him just continuing to collect paychecks by being ready and being a professional. When you look at Brock Purdy, doesn't have the strongest arm in the world. You know what Kyle Shanahan is as an offensive mind, and he's not going to babysit. And I understand that Brock didn't play the most aesthetically pleasing game last week, but coming off the bench, cold, not expecting to play, find yourself in a deficit to pull out a win, 33-17, even if it required some help of the defense, I think that's a little confidence builder there, right? I mean, Miami was an 8-win team coming into that game. So I don't think it's completely done in terms of what San Francisco can be moving forward in the regular season, but I certainly do believe that this probably caps their ceiling. We'll see. Maybe Brock Purdy comes out and he's super accurate and efficient, right? I mean, you look at Kyle Shanahan's offense, it's built for quarterbacks. You don't need to be the best quarterback. Just get the ball out on time, throw it accurately. The way these receivers operate, right, it's about yards after the catch. You just got to hit them in stride. It's not about fitting balls into tight windows. So we'll see what comes of Brock Purdy. And, you know, again, just kind of frustrating and don't want to vent, but you know, two of our larger futures this season are the 49ers over 9.5 wins and the Baltimore Ravens to to make the playoffs, and suddenly we have starting quarterbacks out in both. So here we are on a Monday morning.
Fred Warner did have strong words, though. Said that he was impressed with Brock Purdy and the way he handled the scout team. Clearly, that translates to on-field performance. But obviously, the jury is still out. We'll see what Brock Purdy looks like, especially as there's more and more film for opposing defensive coordinators to look at and prepare for what he does well to see how he goes outside the box. You can follow Payne on Twitter, at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Most importantly, as always, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. Look ahead lines, Payne, a couple of market adjustments, obviously having to do with injury and a variety of other reasons, so we can kind of run through these relatively quickly. Minnesota Vikings were 3-point favorites on the road at the Detroit Lions. The Vikings win the game on the football field against the Jets, get dominated in the box score. The Detroit Lions dominate on the scoreboard and dominate in the box score, and here we are, a 3-point adjustment with the Vikings and Lions now listed at a pick 'em.
Yeah, I think you said it perfectly. Minnesota continuing to win games on the scoreboard that they're not winning metrically. The Detroit Lions trending extremely well the last 6 weeks. Played some tough teams over that stretch. Blew out the Jacksonville Jaguars yesterday. And just to kind of put this in context, right, the Vikings were 3 in the look-ahead line. It reopened plus 1.5. And last night and early this morning, professional bettors were not being swayed away from the Lions' side, not getting the 3. Plus 1.5, plus 1. It's the reason why the sharper shop right now has the Lions minus 1 as a favorite. So ultimately, that's what's unfolded there.
Ravens were 4-point road favorites for their trip to Acrisure Field to take on the Pittsburgh Steelers. Now, as we look at the betting screen early on a Monday morning, the Steelers as high as 2.5 in some shops. We've been here before with the Baltimore Ravens. Tyler Huntley, no stranger to running the offense, but obviously doesn't do it as proficiently and effectively as his counterpart in Lamar Jackson.
And correct me if I'm wrong, he's actually had to play the Steelers before. So ultimately, this is about Lamar Jackson missing this game. That's the large adjustment. Pittsburgh, again, trending a little bit better. I will say this. I don't know if people are in tune with social media. They're following some things. But Lamar Jackson, in the middle of that game, obviously he's not in it. He's in the locker room. On social media, just liking posts, liking tweets. Very, very bizarre behavior there. So
there are a lot of things that Lamar has done, on-field performance not being one of them, that would raise some red flags if I was looking to commit the kind of resources it takes to secure the bag for a franchise quarterback. From that to his rant that we saw last week and some of his antics in terms of grabbing fan signs and pushing for, you know, life-changing money. I'm never going to fault anybody for going out there to get what's theirs, but it would be an interesting discussion and to be a fly on the wall in the Baltimore Ravens front office when they try and figure out exactly what kind of commitment they're going to make to Lamar as the face of the franchise. Staying in that same division, Payne, the Cincinnati Bengals, 3.5-point favorites on a look-ahead number. We see them hold serve at home, winning outright against Kansas City as short home underdogs. The Cleveland Browns do win and cover against the Houston Texans, albeit nothing dominant about that effort whatsoever. And you've seen the Bengals go from 3.5 out to 5, 5.5. And revenge, yep. Clearly a dish best served cold, knowing what happened on Monday Night Football a few weeks ago.
You do have the Cincinnati Bengals going from 3.5 to 5.5. You get the upset win against the Chiefs. Deshaun Watson doesn't look the part in his first game back. What is interesting here, at some point, we're going to reach a number where I think pro bettors potentially would consider the Browns based upon what Kevin Stefanski's been able to do in past matchups, right? Correct me if I'm wrong, Joe Burrow has not beaten the Cleveland Browns yet.
Yep.
Correct?
It has been his bugaboo.
And so,
as well as he's played against Kansas City, the Browns have had his number.
Sometimes you get to a number where, hey, you might not quite feel comfortable, but with division foes, there's something within the matchup that the market just doesn't quite understand. But in to your point, Ja'Marr Chase looked healthy. I would expect his workload to increase a little bit. While I don't think he's worth anything to the spread, signs would point to getting Joe Mixon back. But ultimately, you know, you get to a price where it just doesn't make sense. And this is a guy who thought much higher of Cincinnati than the market, just based upon some of the underlying metrics with what they were doing with Joe Burrow and the changes that were made post bye, and they were getting healthier, and kind of indicated last week when you have a situation where it's virtually a coin flip game at home against an elite team and you can kind of position yourself. And I do understand the schedule that the Bengals will face down the stretch. Sometimes it's really, as a bettor, you want to look at market indicators. And you necessarily don't have to have a true opinion to take advantage of a market. You can go to some of the sharpest shops in the world, that's a tongue twister, and see what their opinion is. And we saw that, right, where the Bengals are 9-1 to win the Super Bowl at a place like Pinnacle, but you can go out west and get 20-1 or 25-1, and that's kind of what I was insinuating. Hey, like, you know, it's probably worth a couple shekels knowing that you're seeing this underlying improvement from the Bengals. The sharpest shop in the world thinks they should be priced 9-1. You can get 25-1 elsewhere. Probably worth a few shekels. Yeah, so
that 25-1.
I think they're trending right.
That 25-1 not available. So hopefully folks gobbled some of that up. I was looking at consensus.
No, it's not going to be available after a win against the Chiefs.
No, I was curious this morning and seems to be 12-1 more or less the consensus. 16-1 was available midway through the first half against the Chiefs yesterday. That number has come down a little bit to where it currently sits. Seattle Seahawks fortunate to get the win on the road against the Los Angeles Rams. Geno Smith game-winning drive against that Rams offensive juggernaut led by John Wolford. 7 on the look-ahead number for the Carolina Panthers traveling out to the Pacific Northwest off a bye. That 7 no longer in the market. The 6 is gone. The 5.5 is gone. The 5 is gone. We're down to 4.5. And I have to imagine this number may even tick a little bit lower.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously a guy that you are very friendly with and Craig takes some very large bets on look ahead lines. So I know a couple guys that grabbed 7 and then at reopen yesterday at 6, that game got whacked as well for the Panthers coming off their bye week. We see the defense has continued to play tough. Seattle defensively, I think we're learning a little bit of a fraud, right? We saw that like 4-game improvement where they had played a bunch of shit offenses and had some fortunes of playing those offenses in weather. And then all of a sudden you go out to Germany and a very poor Bucs offense that was struggling went up and down the field on you even yesterday. I mean, for the first time in what feels like all season, the Rams were able to have a ground game. And it was with John Wolford at quarterback, who had 2 interceptions and wasn't really efficient through the air. Still managed just to hang 23 points. So Carolina off the bye, Sam Darnold looks, at least was competent in his first start back, now gets another week to get reacclimated to the offense. And there's been a buy-in from that side of the ball. They want Wilkes to get that job. Wilkes coached for the Arizona Cardinals, so there's some familiarity there for him as well. And ultimately, those are the reasons we're seeing this game tick down from the look ahead of 7 to the reopen of 6 down to the current 4.5 in the market.
Yeah, don't look now. Carolina is able to pull off an outright win against the Seahawks. They get a little help from the New Orleans Saints on Monday Night Football. And the NFC South, it is clearly the worst division in football from top to bottom, gets to be that much more of a muddled mess with the improbable getting slightly more probable with one of the dark horses coming from off the pace. 49ers, Payne, they're going to play Tampa next week. We, of course, haven't seen Tampa's performance in week 13, but the market responds to the quarterback injury. The 49ers, 6.5 on the look-ahead number. We're down to a field goal here. We'll see where this number gets pushed based on what we get from the Bucs on Monday Night Football.
I've ran long on some of these look-ahead games, so I'm going to just keep it simple. Jimmy G.
Easy enough, short, concise, and the perfect way to go about things. You mentioned Jimmy G, and we try and extrapolate out what injuries mean. Jimmy won't be back this season for the 49ers, but there will be a number of key contributors that dot their team's rosters, and that's why we bring in a medical professional, the good Doc Deepak, to break some of these things down for us.
Are you injured or are you hurt?
When injuries occur in the NFL, you need someone to call on.
If you hurt, you can still play. If you're injured, you can't.
Let's check in with Dr. Deepak Chona. Stanford and Harvard trained orthopedic sports surgeon and founder of SportsMed Analytics, the industry leader in data-driven injury analysis.
So are you hurt or are you injured?
All right, thanks guys. We had a ton of activity on the injury report this weekend, so we'll dive right in. Starting with Lamar Jackson. Now, video suggested a PCL type injury. The fact that they're already saying it's not season ending probably means a sprain plus or minus a bone bruise, but importantly, not a tear. Now, the average on this would be about 2 to 4 weeks. Their early comments lean us towards the lower end of that spectrum, so we're thinking about 2 weeks for Lamar Jackson. Then we have Jimmy G. Now, he is, of course, out for the season, going to have foot surgery on a fracture. These are the types of injuries that skill position players do take a little while to ramp back up, and we saw that with Travis Etienne having a little slow start to this, the beginning of this year. But in Jimmy G's case, especially as a pocket QB, we would expect a full recovery and start to the 2023 season. Then we have Trevor Lawrence. Now, he torqued his knee and ankle pretty impressively, but he was still able to run afterwards. So he likely does have some mild sprain with some soreness to come this week, but not enough to expect a performance impact going forward. Then we have Tua Tagovailoa. Now, you can't say much about him not returning since the game was already in the Niners' control and it was right at the very end of the game where he reportedly had this injury. It does sound like a low ankle sprain, most of which would be played through by a quarterback. How long it takes him to return to practice will confirm the story going forward. And then we have Matthew Stafford, likely out the rest of the season with a spinal cord contusion. These can be really painful, sometimes even cause some temporary weakness. There's a good chance that this resolves fully with rest, so most likely we're looking at a healthy start to the 2023 season here. Then Cortland Sutton. The average wide receiver hamstring takes about 3 weeks, but there is some variation depending on severity. MRI tomorrow and then practice reports Thursday and Friday will allow us to more precisely project his timeline. And Kenneth Walker, now reportedly jammed his ankle. The fact that they were taping him up kind of aggressively suggests that this was a relatively low severity injury that he was considering playing through. Most commonly, these types of ankle issues would cost 0 or 1 game for a running back. When they do return, they do so with a little bit of an elevated re-injury risk, but not much lingering performance impact. And then Joe Mixon. Now, he missed week 13 in the concussion protocol. He would be a heavy outlier to not get cleared in time for week 14, so we would look for Mixon to come back. When running backs return off of concussions, even ones that take a little extra time, they do tend to return to pre-injury level of performance. Then DeAndre Swift. Swift's health has likely played a role in his usage up to this point, but he should now be nearing full strength from his lingering ankle and shoulder injuries. Look for steady improvements in workload. What we saw week 13 is very likely sustainable for DeAndre Swift. And then Treylon Burks. Now, he was ruled out of week 14 with a concussion. He does have an outside chance, week 13 with a concussion. He does have an outside chance to return week 14, but more commonly would be coming back week 15 after one game missed. No performance hit is usually seen for wide receivers off of concussions. And then Deebo Samuel. Now, his stats look like a weak game, but truthfully, this was somewhat expected this soon from a serious quad contusion. Look for rapid improvements weeks 14 and 15. And then Ja'Marr Chase. Now, he looked great, and he should reliably be back to your plug-and-play wide receiver 1 level the rest of this season. And then Odell Beckham Jr. Now, a lot of buzz in the air about him. OBJ has a real chance to contribute this year, but not likely much in the regular season. ACL data projects him to be at 80 to 85% at this point, hitting 90 in mid-January. That's a really solid player who could make a difference for a contender, but probably not in time for fantasy teams. Then Mike Williams. Now, re-aggravated high ankle sprains average an additional 3 to 4 weeks out, but they also cause lingering performance dips that last up to 2 weeks post-return. Williams has a chance to return week 14 or 15, but we wouldn't be looking to start him until at least his second game back. And that's all for now. I'll turn it back to y'all.
You, of course, can follow Deepak Shona on Twitter. That's at SportMDAnalysis, an outstanding guy that loves to interact with a lot of our listeners. He'll provide fresh perspective and been a huge addition for us to kind of take things to the next level. And Payne, you know, with Lamar Jackson being out, I mean, Baltimore was here last year. You begin to wonder if Tyler Huntley learned from that experience and can find a way to sneak this team into the playoffs with Lamar's timeline very much up in the air.
Agreed. We're hoping it's obviously on the short end of that spectrum, and Deepak is spot on, hopefully, in that it's just a 2-week injury. But this is something that we've kind of talked about, and there was an interesting article and conversation that was had, and I'm going to take it to the college ranks with DTR and Chip Kelly. But Chip Kelly told DTR to go out last year, and he ended up returning this season to UCLA. And the synopsis of Chip's opinion was like, hey, you can make a shit ton of money right now in this league with the transition to more quarterbacks with mobility. And it doesn't necessarily have to be in the starter's role, but kind of reeling this all the way back to Baltimore, there's probably better quarterbacks than Tyler Huntley. It just allows Baltimore not to change their system completely because they find a quarterback that has some of the traits of Lamar Jackson. Even you go to the third string quarterback in a Trace McSorley. All of these quarterbacks mesh their system so you don't have to change the system at some point in the middle of a week during the middle of the season. And that's kind of what we have here in terms of Tyler Huntley being uber familiar with the system. They'll incorporate some things that he likes to do a little bit more than Lamar. And I think this will be a game effort from them this week against the Steelers, who are trending quite well.
Going to need your defense to step up. You spend a lot of money on that side of the ball. The Ravens defense had been one of their foibles early in the year with fourth quarter meltdowns. We'll see if that group can elevate its level of play, if Baltimore is going to get to the playoffs or potentially win the AFC North. One final game, though, before we get into week 14, and of course we'll be back with you as we are every Thursday to break down the slate in its entirety. To cap week 13 is the Saints and Bucks, and this number has been fascinating to watch, and I think it's probably the single best talking point about this game. Tampa opened as much as a 6.5-point favorite. Number came crashing all the way down to as low as a flat 3 that we saw in a number of marquee shops earlier today. As we're recording here on a Monday morning, you're starting to see a little bit of Tampa money coming back into the market. 3-20, kind of the prevailing price. There are some 3.5s, as always, shop around depending on what side you're looking for. Tampa enters this game with a lead in the NFC South at 5-6. It's the third time since divisional realignment back in 2002 that every team has a losing record in a division through week 12. It happened 2014 in this very same division, in 2020 in the NFC East. There have been 3 division winners with a losing record all time. Tampa, the dubious distinction, as we've talked about multiple times this year, one of 53 teams to be favored in each of the first 11 games of a season since 1970. That's not dubious, but they are the only one of those 53 teams with a losing record through those first 11. The first meeting was best described for me as a mess. Game was tied 3-3 with 8 minutes remaining in the fourth quarter. Jameis Winston struggled with turnovers, led to the team becoming unraveled. Ultimately, it was a Tampa 20-10 victory. When you look at the Bucs, the market has clearly had them a little bit overvalued. You wonder when it reaches an equilibrium point. They're a robust 1-7-1 ATS in their last 9 overall. When you're looking at some of the injuries for New Orleans, Juwan Johnson, one of the most consistent scoring threats of late for the Saints, will be out at the tight end position. Safety depth compromised. PJ Williams and JT Gray out. We're going to monitor the injury report, see if Marshawn Lattimore can make his first appearance in quite some time. On the Bucs side, Tristan Wirfs along the offensive line, high ankle sprain, he's out. Defensive back depth will be tested. All guys listed as doubtful: Mike Edwards, Antoine Winfield, and Sean Murphy Bunting in the slot. A number of players questionable for Tampa. When you look at this game, Payne, we know Dennis Allen has gotten the best of Tom Brady more often than not. This New Orleans Saints offense has looked absolutely dreadful. The only team that's been worse since week 9 is the Denver Broncos. Not sure which is the most compelling matchup that you want to watch tonight in terms of determining who you think can get to the window with Tampa, a 3-point favorite.
Yeah, I mean, let's start with the Saints on offense, because you kind of mentioned some of their downfalls offensively in recent weeks. I would think that's partly due to some of the defenses they've played, just kind of a gauntlet there. I think, you know, we talk about this pretty frequently, like how you can find value in spotting anomalies. And you do just look back to last week where the Saints scored 0 points and they lost on the scoreboard and they didn't cover. Look at the advanced box score, though, and New Orleans did cover. You had catches that were ruled incomplete that would have set the Saints offense up in prime field position. You had a missed field goal. You had Kamara fumbling twice, once at the 1-yard line, once that set the 49ers offense up right outside the green zone. And those two fumbles alone were roughly like 10 points in EPA. And when you pair that Saints anomaly with the way Todd Bowles and Byron Leftwich are operating the Buccaneers, playing not to lose, very conservative. And you mentioned some of the injuries, right? Specifically in the secondary for the Bucs, right? Antoine Winfield Jr. and Sean Murphy Bunting and Mike Edwards. That's three of Tampa's top five guys in the secondary that are out. And then you even look at the big guys inside, right? Vita Vea is dealing with a foot injury. He was questionable last week against the Browns, and you know he's missed or been limited in practice all week. And then Akeem Hicks randomly gets added to the injury report after missing practice Friday with a foot injury of his own, and he got a limited in on Saturday and is questionable. You have to monitor those two guys. My feeling is if they play, you know, just it makes their defense a little bit different, right? But if somehow one or either of those guys are out up the middle, the Buccaneers' run defense drops off a cliff when Vea or Hicks are off the field. And so suddenly, you know, you can see why we've gone from 6-3 here. I think Olave should find some success against a beat-up secondary. His target share increased again last week after about a one-week dip. I would assume, as you alluded to with Juwan Johnson being out, in a game that appears to be a grinder, it means more Taysom Hill. I don't know if that's a positive or a negative. I mean, he had the one-week explosion, but he's been largely inefficient in a lot of his touches. To your point, right, we're starting to see this. Now that we're at three, my gut says if Vita and Hicks both play, and some of the guys in the Saints secondary that we'll talk about in a moment here that are listed as questionable, if they don't actually end up playing, we're going to see a touch of buyback, and this game's going to close 3.5 or maybe even soft 4.
Yeah, it's just so wild when you look at everything that's at stake here. Obviously, the Saints season hanging in the balance. A win here keeps them on life support. A loss here pretty much sends them into the abyss to try and do a little bit of soul searching and figure out if Dennis Allen is the job for the guy and what their quarterback room will look like coming out of an added week of rest that Andy Dalton hasn't exactly moved the troops. Tampa offensively, Payne, I mean, this group has looked to try and find an identity. It's been a struggle, to say the least. 18.2 points per game, 27th in the league. From a red zone standpoint, you highlighted it way back in week one against the Dallas Cowboys, and it's been something that they haven't been able to work through whatsoever. Against Dennis Allen, Tom Brady, 11 total touchdowns and 11 turnovers against the Saints in six games, 59% completions and a sub-76 passer rating. When you look at the Bucs, one of their strengths has been their ability to keep Brady upright. They've allowed just 17 sacks all season long. We're not quite sure what's going on. Him and Mike Evans don't appear to be on the same page. Fortunately for the Bucs, Brady and Godwin as electric as ever in terms of their ability to operate out of the slot. And the running back room, will it be Leonard Fournette? Will it be Rashad White? How those carries will get distributed. But New Orleans, a shell of itself defensively as far as a overall season-long body of work.
So, to your point, I don't think Dennis Allen is the guy for this job long term. I think he's kind of proven that to this point. But in this specific matchup, he has been that dude. And he's continued to give Tom Brady and the Buccaneers offense trouble the past few weeks. If you just look at the five matchups, Brady's 1-4 straight up and against the spread. And you start to think about week two, that matchup, the lone cover and win for the Buccaneers against Dennis Allen. It really wasn't Tom Brady suddenly solving Dennis Allen's defense. The Saints just turned it over five times. And what was a little bit different in the first four meetings was that Dennis Allen was able to get pressure on Tom Brady. And in the first four matchups, the Saints got pressure on Brady at a 12% higher rate than what Brady had been pressured during his entire Bucs tenure. That changed a little bit because Tampa changed their offense in that meeting. They got the ball out of Tom Brady's hands super quick. It was a 2.3-second release time. So the Saints only had an 11% pressure rate. That has dwindled a little bit this season for the Saints in general. But you did watch Dennis Allen realize they weren't getting to Tom Brady, and he adjusted his defense back. And he went with more coverage concepts, knowing the Buccaneers at that point had a beat up wide receiver room, and that approach really worked. Again, it didn't work on the scoreboard, but Brady ended that game with a 27 QBR back in week two. He was quarterback 29 out of 33 in EPA plus completion percentage above expectation. So it's very fair to say, like, in these five meetings, Dennis Allen is really, really giving Tom Brady fits. And now Tristan Wirfs is out for Tampa at right tackle, and the Buccaneers are starting just two of their five projected linemen that they had penciled in this offseason. You also have the Saints defense. It's actually trending better metrically. Weeks 1 through 7, New Orleans was 20th in EPA per play allowed against a schedule of offenses that ranked 18th in efficiency. From Week 8 onward, though, the Saints' defense is 10th in EPA per play allowed against an above-average schedule of offenses, and they haven't gotten all their parts back defensively yet. So that's something to keep an eye on as well here, right? We kind of mentioned Marshon Lattimore. He's returned to practice, started practicing last week. He's been limited all this week. Never got in a full. So let's see if he plays tonight. There was some optimism, but I don't think it's like a done deal that Marshon Lattimore goes. Bradley Roby finally got in a limited on Saturday. Let's see if that's enough to, you know, clear the concussion protocol. PJ Williams is out. We know the Saints traded away Chauncey Gardner. So you're starting to like see the Saints secondary. Like, I don't know if it's actually going to be what we think it might be tonight. And just again, based on trending play, it's probably a Chris Godwin night, especially if Tom is getting rid of the ball quickly. Godwin's really looked like he's fully back now at this point after ACL surgery, and you just look at his target share. It's the second most since week 6. Saints have been pretty vulnerable defending the slot. Again, like it's not the most fun breaking down a game that's moved 3.5 points, and it'll be interesting to see where this ultimately closes. I do think we're going to get back to at least 3.5 here based upon some of these injuries that will ultimately unfold here in the next, you know, 7 hours until kickoff.
A busy Monday morning in the National Football League, by the way, as well. A little bit of breaking news. And you do wonder, Payne, if someone in the Bay Area will pick up the phone. Baker Mayfield officially released by the Carolina Panthers. I wonder if he becomes a fit for San Francisco, if you're talking about Brock Purdy or a player with a little bit more experience that has a track record of being decent with a run-heavy offensive attack.
Yeah, that'll be interesting to monitor. Maybe that's a better fit than Josh Johnson. I do think this is Brock Purdy's job to lose, at least over the next handful of weeks, knowing his familiarity with the system. And again, right? Well, I think we maybe have some thoughts to his play at Iowa State, and we know he doesn't have the strongest arm, but he's been in this system and he can operate it a little bit. Again, threw a couple interceptions yesterday that were somewhat costly, but again, he goes in the game, his team's trailing, comes in cold off the bench and gets his team a win. So I think it's Brock Purdy's job to lose, but maybe they make that call to Baker Mayfield. We'll see.
One last thing on the Monday Night Football game, because I know ESPN will circulate some of these numbers. It'll be a prominent talking point from now until kickoff, so we'll get them out of the way for all of our loyal listeners first. Andy Dalton hasn't exactly been great in primetime. 6-20 straight up in the last 26 games that he's played under the bright lights. 34 touchdown passes, 24 interceptions, a 79 passer rating. He has lost 7 straight games in primetime by 8-plus points apiece. Last win coming back in 2018 against the Baltimore Ravens. His record from a straight-up standpoint is the worst since the merger, with a minimum of 25 starts. 9-7 ATS in his career during that particular span. All things to factor into your handicapping equation. Like you said, it'll be interesting to see where some of the sharper shops that have gotten down to that 3 flat ultimately do close before we get to kickoff tonight at 8:15 Eastern. Any other words of wisdom, little tidbits, nuggets, things that you would like to pass along? As I know we've gone long for a Monday morning. We seem to always say that like a broken record around here.
Carolina Panthers down to 3.5. Wow.
It started the momentum last night, and it's already on the move. Go figure. All right, for Payne Insider, follow him on Twitter, at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Most importantly, follow the podcast, at Bet the Board Pod. Best of luck with all of your Monday Night Football investments, wherever your handicapping takes you. Remember, no Wednesday college football podcast this week. We will be back with the National Football League, though, on Thursday to talk about all things Week 14. And in the meantime, hopefully we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.